This is the Media Freak podcast. It's the latest and greatest podcast created by media people who are just a little bit freaky. We're not the big dogs. We're the ones in the media trenches who tell you how it really is. Each episode, you'll hear from us with a roundup of media news, our expert guests, and some anonymous sources about the freaky world of media. So who's on the mic? The exciting news is that we've mixed up the crowd this week. It's still me, your host, Harriet from Publicis, Jack from Craft.
Top of the morning to you.
Bookie from Wavemaker.
What up?
And we're pleased to announce that Daniel Sitzel, Managing Director at Webtopia, has joined the crew.
Hello.
Hey, Daniel, how are you doing?
Wonderful. How are you doing?
Very, very well. So, Daniel, you're a digital lead with a lot of experience leading performance teams in the network agency world. So we're very happy to have you on the pod. It's
a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We've got someone with actual brains joining us, have we?
Thankfully. Finally.
That's not a dig at Charlie, by the way. He's not here to defend himself.
Well, Charlie from Show Heroes will be back as normal next week. I look forward to that awkward episode. But in today's, we discuss the latest evolutions in the social and search landscape, sponsorship pullback within LGBTQ plus media and events, and hear more from Daniel about solutions available for SMEs in the evolving ecosystem. So let's get into it. In the search and social landscape. In our last episode, Jack mentioned that Instagram is now allowing search engines like Google to display public posts on search results pages. I'm pleased to reveal that this is not fake news, and Jack was very much correct.
I don't make it up as I go.
You don't. And as of July, eligible content, including photos, reels, carousels, captions, and profile bios, can appear in search results, but private and personal accounts are totally excluded. Now, it's no surprise that this update has rolled out. The rise of social search has been building for years. So, Daniel, what do you think about this change?
Fascinating. I think my first ever job was SEO link building about 20 years ago, or closer after that.
Nice.
But I love SEO and have a real soft spot for it, and think it's a very welcome change to see the paid media world going that one step closer to ensuring that all the copy, everything we're talking about in paid ads, considers SEO value at the same time.
Well, the shift highlights obviously how social media is becoming the destination of discovery. But ChatGPT and AI are also changing search. ChatGPT could get more search traffic than Google by 2030.
By 2030? We've got a while then.
We do have a while. We'll still probably be working though.
So, questions
for you. For media agencies and creators, will this shift on Instagram change how we measure performance?
Absolutely.
Sorry, go ahead, Zana.
Oh, I was going to say, absolutely. I think it will, to the extent that we're going to now consider organic content as a measure of performance as well, that we can start building ad campaigns in search environments around what organic content is going to be showing alongside it.
SEO-tial.
Love that.
I was about to say, Daniel, that was actually very clever, and then you went and ruined it.
I'm sorry. I'm like the cowbell at the end of the symphony.
Nice.
And my other question is, is Meta's decision to open up Instagram content to Google a strategic move to keep up in a world where AI-powered search tools like ChatGPT are rapidly changing how people find content, especially when competitors like TikTok and YouTube already lead in search-driven discovery?
I think hugely. I think the days are numbered for, you know, the walled gardens having their walls so high there needs to be some element of collaboration, because everyone is curating their own digital media ecosystems. And if they are so separate from the likes of Google or whatever, then they're causing themselves a problem. So I think, it's a smart strategic move. I think they waited as long as they could have done in terms of protecting their data and protecting all of this kind of stuff. But the time has come and they've got to do it. So, yeah.
So basically we're saying that now there's a bigger kid in the playground. The two previous bullies are having to team up to try and protect themselves.
That is exactly it.
They're BFFs now.
I think to add, social search is becoming a big thing, but the social platforms probably accepted that the functionality of searching in social platforms was rubbish. And the aggregated view you get through Google, now through ChatGPT, is what consumers want. They want that aggregation of search results in a really simple to navigate view, and they've just never been able to replicate that effectively in social platforms. So I guess by opening up that data to Google, they're saying, well, we're not going to be able to replicate that aggregated view ourselves, but we'll happily now release more content for you to be able to show in the aggregated view and make sure that we have more of an opportunity to keep that traffic coming back to us, instead of the ChatGPT, where they've not really been able to affect how that content is being displayed.
Do we actually think that we might see companies have a higher CTR from their search because it's going to Instagram? Because as people, as consumers, we know what we're like. Sometimes you're like, I'm not clicking on the ad, just go to your website. But if you're going to Instagram, I'm like, oh, cool, I know what that's about. And we might even see CTRs for search increase even further. And I'll leave it there.
Really important. You make great points. I think brands have really struggled to understand how to elevate their organic profile. They put a lot of investment and time into organic social content, but often don't get much return from it. So maybe this is a great way of amplifying the value that the sort of organic profile they're trying to build, which is a completely different profile what brands are building in the paid space.
Nice.
Very good. Very good. To be continued. Well, let's move on. In other industry news, it's Pride season. It's a time to celebrate LGBTQ+ identity, visibility, and progress with a spotlight on inclusion. So for brands, it's often seen as a key moment to show allyship and connect meaningfully with diverse audiences. But this year, things are not actually as positive. The Gay Times has lost 80% of its advertisers since 2024. 80% is a huge amount. And 75% of Pride events have also seen a drop in corporate sponsorships, with one in four reporting revenue down by more than half. So this is obviously against the backdrop of consumer engagement with LGBTQ+ content rising. And with that considered, half of Gen Z no longer identify as exclusively heterosexual. So my first question to you is, why do you think there's a disconnect between audience and an advertiser around this? And Buki, I'm going to put this to you first.
It's a really interesting topic that I think I've spoken about at length, because I've worked in, you know, our DE&I communities within the company and everything like that. And there is a huge, huge disconnect. I think in terms of the way that advertisers and brands and companies are going, if you think about the reason why they have previously supported, you know, marginalized community, I know we're talking about LGBTQ+ right now, but we're talking about all communities, all marginalized communities. It has always been in pursuit of profit, like ultimately. And in that way, we will talk about it as like, you know, it isn't support, it's strategy. Like you often hear that. It's another line on the media plan. It's another audience. And so we kind of got this disconnect in that, you know, companies starting to roll all of this back, even though more and more people are identifying or, you know, identifying as certain groups. And I feel like brands are just not really sure what their role is to play in society right now. Because if it's completely in pursuit of profit, then And also cost cutting. If you're going to cut something, you want to cut this. It's going to be the first thing that's going to go off the plan because everything has a wider audience technically, even though we're now into 50%. But if you look at where people have moved into, brands are actually starting to take more of a role in like society. And I think now they're confused. They're like, oh, are we helping? Are we just supporting? Are we paying for it? Nobody really knows. So I think we're seeing a real confusion in terms of leadership as to whether this is just a profit driving thing for them, in which case it's fine to cut, or if they actually support and they're going to have to do that in other ways. So I think they're just a bit confused, ironically.
I think there's a lot of brands, like, I think knowing how skittish marketing departments can be, particularly if they have an underrepresentation of people from that community, they're going to start worrying about things like, what if I get it wrong? What if I'm accused of rainbow washing just by kind of like by sponsoring an event, which obviously there's various depths that you can go to of like your involvement and your support of the community. But from like quite a cold, you know, to go with the profit argument, from like quite a cold viewpoint, if lots of brands are pulling out of a space, but you know, there's a big and active and engaged audience there, then you've got a real opportunity to get even more stand out than you would have otherwise. But also, you know, you would assume that people within that community would value those who are kind of coming in and sponsoring it when other people are pulling away. So there's like, it's almost like a double opportunity because of it.
Well, my question or follow-up question to your point, Spooky and Jack, is whether or not year-round investment matters. Do brands need to invest, you know, continuously to make it meaningful, or does a, you know, one-off Pride event here and there?
It's not enough. I don't think, because if you support it, and this is where the distinction in terms of the intention is the real thing, because if your intention is profit, then yeah, a one-off thing might be enough for you, but you won't reap the full benefit. If you're going to do this, you're looking at the Gay Times. If they're 80% of their profit or their revenues are down, they're not going to exist next year. I actually was doing some research. They had to raise 150K off their own back. They've made their readers shareholders. They've now bought equity in the company in order to continue because of the way that brands have pulled back. So I think if you are just going to do a one-off, then you actually probably don't support the community. You're just in pursuit of profit, in which case I think the answer to your question is very, very clear. But if you are going to support them or support any community, there are ways to do it. And if you're not going to take a year-round approach, you just need to kind of weave it into your culture. That's the only other way that you're going to support it. If you're not going to have like an active and a big and a visible campaign, like the culture of your business from top to bottom needs to eat, sleep and breathe equity and inclusion.
I mean, it's kind of like with any section of any cultural sort of touch point within, you know, the world that we work in. It's like, if you just show up and sort of quickly profiteer and then fuck off again, if that's like, you know, even in music, for example, you just kind of show up, stick a badge on something, no depth to it, and you fuck off, it's just bad planning. Like, it doesn't make any sense to just kind of be like, yeah, right, yep, smash and grab, see you later.
Gamers are really good at that. Like, usually, yeah, if a brand shows up, does smash and grab, gamers go, fuck you.
Yeah.
we know what you're doing, and they don't like it. But if you actually show, like, I think actually, if you do a one-off, then I don't think you actually support the community. Then, like, you know, it's like going to one of your friend's birthdays and never any of the others. That's not your friend.
You said a couple of things here that I just want to build on. One is that having that evergreen content all year round is representative of inclusion, I think, is so important. And I do think more and more brands are doing that. So, and then there's also this fear of having this one-off isolated message, which could be criticized. And the last two or three years, there's just been such heavy criticism for brands that have had this isolated message that isn't evergreen. It's not representative of what they're doing the rest of the year. And they are scared. And I suspect that's a big reason for brands pulling out of some of those other events or publications, because they just don't feel they've got an appropriate isolated message in that environment. And that could be reflective of the lack of representation in the marketing departments, as you mentioned, Jack, like that. It could be a fear they're just not going to be able to say the right thing. It's easier to have evergreen content that's inclusive that isn't a specific tactical message than to maybe have something more powerful. But I think that is a problem in itself. It comes across as lazy, and that is also, when was it? Sometime last year, corporations started putting back on DE&I and saying we don't need to have these specific policies to support DE&I. We'll just assume that everything's going to be okay. It's laziness. It's fear and laziness.
I like that. I think there's two things actually from there. There's one thing that we've skirted around is actually, and it goes back to your original question, Harriet, and why is there a disconnect in terms of the population and the brands? I actually think a lot of it is politics, like actual genuine politics. What's going on in the States? What's going on over here? The polarization and the weaponization of marginalized groups, I think, has really made people say, we need to stay away from it. So that's the one thing. And I think, Daniel, you're actually bang on in terms of like it being lazy. I think people are scared of doing the wrong thing, so they don't work at doing the right thing. Mm. And that's the problem. You're like, we're just not going to bother. So I think there's a huge opportunity, actually, to Jack's point. It's double opportunity because people want this stuff. People want brands to be involved. But brands are just kind of leaving a lot on the table in terms of doing this. I think we're talking about LGBT right now, but I remember a couple of years ago talking about some publications that were owned by, I think, like diverse women or whatever. And outside of like Black History Month, they had no revenues and they had to close down. And it's kind of like, so where was all that care and all that support from the brands that supported them in that one month, when actually you could weave it through? And I think an optimistic me would say, maybe it's because they're starting to weave, DE&I through their regular BAU communications. So they're pulling back from targeted, and I wish that was the world right now, because I'd be like, they're pulling back from one-offs because they're actually just weaving them into their regular.
But that would be good.
That would be nice.
I had a question, if that's all right to ask. You mentioned the word targeted, but is the lack of targeting options for communities in the digital space not created this sort of unwillingness to invest in more traditional publication space for more tactical campaigns? Because if you want to pair that with a digital campaign, it's really hard. Because all the social platforms have removed targeting capabilities for any of these
that's such a good point.
Gender, sexuality, etc. And it just becomes really, really hard to have a more well-rounded campaign. So it's like, it's almost like piecing off bits of budget to sponsor something, but actually it can't be part of something bigger because of the lack of targeting options.
That's actually a really good point. I think I hadn't really thought about that in terms of like the main platforms. But it probably all feeds into the whole lot.
Yeah, that is a good point, Daniel. But I am interested in what brands are doing it right. So if you do listen to our spin-off series, Freak of the Week, I am going to task Buki and Jack with doing a Freak of the Week of two LGBTQ+ friendly brand campaigns. So watch this space.
Yeah, I'll just come wading in as a straight white man. Here's what I think.
You get to have an opinion too.
It's about inclusion.
Coming from an ally standpoint, that's what we're going for.
Exactly.
I'm pleased to see I'm up again this week.
I was going to say, I thought you were taking a break, but the reigning champion, he has to continue.
I can do it if you like.
I've not won the past 2 weeks, mate. I'm in relegation.
You're over it.
Wow, yeah, bottom of the table, mate.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it should be, Booker, you should face off against Charlie or something, given that he won last week.
All right, we'll give it a go.
Well, anyway, moving on. In other AI news, so the Media Freak podcast has recently discussed many shifts happening across the holding companies to become AI-driven and AI-centric. We've spoken at length about WPP, who have made headlines with the number of changes happening to embed AI throughout its operations. And Publicis Group quite recently also issued a press release regarding the creation of a new center of excellence for AI transformation. So with network agencies launching full stack services to help clients create infrastructure for managing the entire AI lifecycle, and what about smaller clients and businesses needing kind of automated solutions and software? I feel that we haven't explored that area as closely. So Daniel, conveniently, Webtopia helps brands scale performance, and you often use AI tools without necessarily owning the AI infrastructure. So I'd love to hear from you about this. You know, what does AI transformation actually look like for small to mid-sized brands without access to kind of, you know, bigger budgets that holding agency brands may have?
Much faster adoption is probably the easiest way to answer that. I think we're not slowed down by this need to have this full stack solution that we can offer proprietary to partners. We can identify more tactical automation or AI solutions and tools that we can just bring in, introduce to partners that help them both in their paid, in the paid space as well as their business overall. So a great example of where we've adopted more tactical tools in the creative analysis space. And these are tools I never came across working in the big network agencies. But tools like Magic Brief, it's actually just been bought by Canva, Motion, Foreplay, all provide some level of creative analysis that deliver both visual analysis as well as performance analysis over and above.
Dan, what is this Foreplay tool?
It is a wonderful tool with a fantastic name.
It doesn't suck.
It doesn't suck. It is an excellent tool. Yeah, I feel like Foreplay. They lean on the name.
How are we spelling? I'm assuming it's the number four.
No. Don't assume anything. They've really gone down the road of just type in Foreplay analysis or Foreplay creative analysis. It will come up. But yeah, their messaging really does lean on the phrase more than you would hope it does.
Fair play to them. Is it a plugin?
We've seen really tactical use of creative analysis. Why that's particularly good is because most people listening will know if they've used creative analysis within the social platforms, they leave a lot to be desired. And it's very challenging to draw insights and conclusions on creative performance primarily from the metric analysis you've got available on social platforms. So we utilize a lot more automation tools outside of external party tools, and that's been amazing. That's really helped create a much better creative feedback loop to both our internal creative team and external creative teams and partners. And then the other feature that I just want to draw on that we utilize Magic Brief for is creative research. That's something we could never do through social platforms, is see what other brands do. So we use tools like Magic Brief, and I believe Motion's also, and Foreplay offers the same thing. You can research what other creative competitor brands are running, brands in the same category. You can use that to inspire and share insights back to your partners. And it's a great way to benchmark what you're doing against the rest of the market. So tools like that have just been amazing. We also, one of the things that I think Webtopia does particularly well is it aligns to business objectives. So we like to work with partners that are able to lean on Shopify data. So we work with platforms like Store Hero, which is a total e-commerce tool. So when we're reporting back to partners, we're not just reporting back on platform metrics, but we're using automation tools to report on site metrics. So we can see what the ROAS is, the ROI is of paid media campaigns measured by the e-commerce tool and not just measured. So these are really great examples where we've been able to tactically introduce in tools that may not be possible at the bigger network agencies because they like to do everything proprietarily. They don't like to bring in third-party tools stealing some of that potential revenue, whereas SMEs and more nimble, smaller agencies, but they're very happy to work with partners that have created fantastic technologies that help our clients.
Very good.
It's really interesting kind of what you say, because obviously, as you've been talking, I'm obviously going through all of these because they look really, really interesting. And I'm just harking back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that, you know, with the bigger agencies, they are so concerned with, you know, keeping all of that potential revenue within, almost creating walled gardens themselves. And I'm like, okay, but we've had a look at some of the OG walled gardens, and we see what's going on. So I think what you're saying, this agility and this collaboration, this ability to bring in different platforms into the same thing, creative testing, all of that sounds like it's probably a little bit more geared for the way the world is going a little bit, if I'm not out of turn to say so.
No, it's absolutely true. I think brands are generally suspicious of what they're being told by large network agencies, because they know that that is an issue, that as much revenue as can be kept in that network agency as possible is what the network agency will do.
Well, let's not yeah. bash them too much. You do have two employees at network agencies, so
no, we're not bad. We're just observing.
Give them a bash.
In the MarTech landscape, we'd like to talk to you about Alchemy Network. Alchemy is a unique innovation consultancy that's changing the game when it comes to ad tech. It's a consultancy that helps companies gain competitive advantage through marketing and advertising technology. They work with thousands of brands and agencies and identify needs and interests that save agency folk time by curating the landscape and condensing it down in bespoke bite-sized sessions. They can be used if you have a specific brief in mind or simply as a form of learning and development. So email hello@alchemy-network.co.uk to find out more. So that wraps up the news this week. Remember, you can respond and have your say in any of the topics and stories we discuss on the podcast. Email us. It's info.tmfpod@gmail.com. That's info.tmfpod@gmail.com.
Or DM us on Instagram.
Thank you, Jack. Much, much easier to navigate. Let's move on to our guest segment. So our special 5-minute guest segment today features Daniel from Wedtopia. Can I get a whoop whoop?
Whoop whoop.
Whoop whoop.
I just did that straight
on. Can I whoop myself?
Yeah, you can whoop yourself. You can whoop yourself.
Thank you. So Daniel, this is a very quick fire round here, and we'd love to know a bit more about you and your role. So how would you describe your role at Wedtopia?
So joined as head of performance about 18 months ago. So I was just looking after media and creative teams and then moved into management at the beginning of the year. So now I look after or oversee some of those same teams and also some very exciting teams like finance and HR.
That gets a big whoop whoop.
Yeah, that's
promoted into managing director role. That means you're the big dog in this podcast. So
I'm responsible for the people and our partners. That's the best way to describe it. But that's what I'm enjoying the most, is a lot more responsibility for the people and the environment.
Nice. So you haven't been in like in a empty meeting room woofing like the truth.
It's pretty remote, so no.
Oh, really? Just round the house.
Just round the house and in the co-working space, yeah.
And so, Daniel, what inspired you to kind of pursue this field? Was there a defining moment that made you confident that, you know, Wedtopia was for you?
Two parts of the question. First one is I love accountability. That's why performance marketing has always really appealed to me. I like to be responsible for my own success and the praise coming my way. And that's why I've kind of always loved performance marketing. And Wedtopia, what appealed to me is it was a values-driven business. The interview was conducted based on the values they have. Empathy was probably one of the leading values that came out during the interview process, and throughout the time that I've been here, empathy is the leading value across everything we do. Everything, all our decision-making, both internally and externally, is done through an empathetic lens.
Wow, that's gorgeous.
That is nice.
Love to hear it.
I bet their D&I campaigns are going to be good.
We try. It's hard. It's hard in a remote world to be as inclusive as we'd like to be, but we try.
It almost feels like you don't wouldn't need a campaign, like as a company, because as inclusive, as difficult as it is to be inclusive remote, it feels like, you know, you guys are just nice to each other.
We're trying, exactly. It gives us, we respect personal and cultural kind of expression by giving people like as much time as they need to do so. We've introduced a couple of nice initiatives, things like an equity day, which I really like, which is kind of a day for any cultural expression, religious or non-religious. We do it, we give time off, and a lot of relaxed policies around Ramadan and the Eid, things like that. So there are nice things we can do, but it also means people need to be comfortable in an environment talking about cultural expressions. And I think that can be hard. People often are reserved about talking to colleagues, having chit chat about things they're doing in their own time. So one of the things we try and do is promote that culture where people should be really open. We ask people to share images and share stories about how they're celebrating things.
Amazing. Amazing. And one final question, Daniel. Powerful advice. If you could give one key piece of advice to someone just starting out in the industry, what would it be?
Rely on strengths you've developed in your personal life. I think there's very little academia that can push you forward into the marketing space and advance you above other people around you, but the strengths and learnings you've developed in your personal life, things you feel you're very good at day to day, bring those into the workplace and they'll serve you well.
Love
that's
that.
Good
Love
advice.
That. That's very good.
That's good for me. I'm writing that down myself.
Yeah, we'll take notes. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. That wraps up this week. Thank you so much for listening to the Media Freak podcast. If you like listening to our Freak this week, remember to like, subscribe, and tell your friends. Big thanks again to Daniel at Webtopia and also to Alchemy Network, our long-term commercial partner. Email hello@alchemy-network.co.uk to find out more about their discovery program. Bye.